Well, it's wonderful to see you. Thank you for coming. Thank you for whatever you have done to help this place come into being and continue in its being, because it has affected a lot of people in lots of wonderful ways, and I hope that you are some of them. How are we doing on sound? I could what? I could be a little louder. Okay. Is that better? Okay. We have to wait. There are many arms of the Dharma. Is this better?
Yes.
Thank you to our recording Bodhisattva, Rob. Okay, so thank you. And I want to remember our ancestors at this time of year especially. Each year we get older and older, and we get to face that in a way that really helps to ground us if we wish for that. I want to remember Katagiri Roshi, who is the Japanese Zen teacher who came from his home in Japan and helped us start this lineage, help us learn how to become bodhisattvas. It has bloomed in many ways in many places. And I want to thank our ancestors that preceded the arrival of all of us, our indigenous ancestors who taught us something about how to stay alive, and the ancestors who have made it possible for us to arrive here today. What I want to talk about today is three things that have been coming up for me as a regular thing that I'm noticing when I get up for my day. What can we do? There's a lot going on. A lot of it is distressing a lot of people. What can we do? What if I don't feel like it? A little piece of honesty. And then, what is at stake? So let's just start with a wonderful quote from a book that it's sort of like a daily reader with quotes that I found in a library that somebody donated. And here we go. Meditation takes gumption. It is certainly a great deal easier just to sit back and watch television. So why bother? Why waste all that time and energy when you could be out enjoying yourself? Why? Simple. Because you are a human. And just because of the simple fact that you are human, you find yourself heir to an inherent unsatisfactoriness in life, which simply will not go away. You can suppress it from your awareness for a time. You can distract yourself for hours on end, but it always comes back. Usually, when you least expect it. All of a sudden, seemingly out of the blue, you sit up, you take stock, and you realize your actual situation in life. Now, this is something that I've experienced, this taking stock. But especially lately, it seems like it's happening with a lot of people in a very positive way, where they'll all of a sudden, they'll say something and I'll realize this person has been practicing. And they feel it too. It's sort of like, you know, something's changed. So this is really, really, really important, because we really don't know what's going on. So that is why the Buddha taught us something about how to practice. I'm going to have to keep doing this so that it will stay up. So I'm going to sidestep the three questions that I introduced and sidestep into some of the basic teachings of the Buddha. And in particular, what the Buddha realized about our actual situation in life. So first of all, we're not who we think we are. We think we're beings. But the Buddha said, what we call a being is nothing but a combination of ever-changing physical and mental forces or energies, which may be divided into five groups called the five aggregates. That includes matter or form, so our five senses, the objects of those senses, sensations, and it also includes mind. We normally think of matter as being something we can touch. It is certainly something that we have some ability to experience, but it also includes energies that are not physical, and that is what our mind is. It is the sense that recognizes thought, which is something that our eyes and ears can't do. We normally don't think of our mind that way, but that's part of the issue of we're not who we think we are. So we have sensations. We kind of know what those are. Smelling, hearing, seeing. We have perceptions, and that aggregate is about recognition as opposed to the aggregate of consciousness, which is about awareness. So we can see, but we don't necessarily recognize what we're seeing. And then we have mental formations. Mental formations are karma. Mental formations are volition or thirst. Thirst being the cause of dukkha, which is that unsatisfactoriness that won't go away that we heard about in the quote. Now, this is stuff almost everybody here has heard, and we've certainly all experienced. So, kind of, what's the big deal? Well, this is where suddenly we'll wake up, and all of a sudden we'll realize, oh, that's what that meant. That's what that meant. And we begin to see things differently. And the different that we see is how things really are. So a great deal of what goes on in our lives has to do with the fact that we have an obstructed view of how things really are and how they operate. So the five aggregates themselves, which are just more labels, like being in a way, but we have to be able to talk about them to take them in. The five aggregates together are what we usually call being, a being, myself, and they are also dukkha or unsatisfactoriness in and of itself. So there's a phrase in one of our chants, the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. And the jewel mirror is the perfect reflection of how things really are. And that one of the phrases in there are, you are not it, but in truth, it is you. So I think I am the being. But in fact, the five aggregates, which are not solid things, the operating of the universe is sort of what's arising and that I'm calling being. So that's a big shift. That's a big shift. Try taking I out of the equation. There really isn't a being that we can put our hands on. And the reason we can't put our hands on it is because it is perpetually changing. It is changing at the speed of light. And it is not even, there's not even really a connection between one of those moments and the next. It is really that a serial equation that just keeps going perpetually. So this doesn't really, you know, it's like, okay, it's good to know a little bit about this, but let's get back to the questions. What can I do? How can I live my life? What if I don't feel like it? So let me keep going. I'm repeating things that we all know, and yet each time I go into depth into the basic teachings of the Buddha about suffering, the cause of suffering, the existence of non-suffering, and the path for living our lives, I learn something. So the five aggregates together are what we call being. They are dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness themselves. There is no other being or I standing behind. There's nothing outside of matter and sensations and perceptions and consciousness and mental formations or volition. Suffering exists, but there's no sufferer. Deeds exist, but there's no doer. Only movement, no unmoving mover behind the movement. Now, this is something we can hear. We can observe each other, but it usually doesn't come up that way for us. There was once a great question in a class that I had where somebody said, well, how could my thoughts not be personal? And the teacher said, she said, what's not personal about my thoughts? And he looked at her and he said, you. And that was a turning moment for me. It was like, oh. And when that turning moment comes, it disappears as fast as it came up. But if we keep attending continually to what's actually going on, and with some help from the Buddha on paths that we don't have to go down and that aren't going to help us a lot with what we're looking for, and you know, well, let me keep going. So we're not who we think we are. And what suffering is and the cause of it is not what we think it is. I mean, we all know something about suffering, right? We oftentimes say, well, I wouldn't necessarily call that suffering because that sounds like too severe. So we have a picture of what the word suffering means. And we're very familiar with being unsatisfied with, like, I'm not getting what I want. I'm losing the things that I cherish the most. But unsatisfactoriness goes a lot more deeply than that. The Buddha had a very seriously devoted student who had had to go through a great deal to get his parents' permissions to actually become a student of Buddha's. And then he put aside everything and really went at it. And the Buddha said to him, "The world lacks and hankers and is enslaved to thirst." This is primarily, but not exclusively, what is the source of unsatisfactoriness. So, mental formations are also volitions, or like will, like anger, like restlessness. All of those are in the mental sphere, and they are all forms of energy. So mental formations are not just, what am I going to get so-and-so for Christmas? Although they're included. Mental formations are also volition. And the Buddha said, when asked what karma was, he said, "Volition is karma." Now, what does that mean? We normally think about karma as a kind of universal court. We reap what we sow, is what most of us think of as karma. From the Buddhist standpoint, karma is only one thing, and that is thirst. And not just any old thirst, but unquenchable thirst. So, let me see, there's a wonderful definition of it here. Yes. And thirst is also karma because it arises from mental formations. So, all of these terms, mental formations, karma, thirst, all denote the same thing, the desire, the will to live, to exist, to re-exist, to become more and more, to grow more and more, to accumulate more and more. Now, when I hear that definition, when I read that, it just stopped me in my tracks. I thought, well, that's the thing I'm asking the question, what can I do about? I can see that hunger, right? That it's rapacious. It's very, very powerful. It's so powerful that even though we see it arising interdependently with all the five aggregates, you can't just set aside and say, okay, here's volition, now here's the rest of it. None of it can exist without dependence on everything else. So matter can't stand without perceptions and sensations and consciousness and volition. And likewise, mind formations don't arise independently. They can't exist without a body. But unquenchable thirst or karma, which is just the thirst, it's not the result. It isn't cause and effect, which is the way we normally think about it, or we commonly do. It's just the existence of this energy. So it is this thirst that is the cause of the arising of dukkha. And it is found, it's part of being. It's part of life. So it's part of what we normally think of as I. So this very thirst is what gives rise to dukkha and anything that's impermanent, which is us and everything else, is dukkha. Even joy simply because it's impermanent. It's unsatisfactory, it's dukkha, and it arises out of this hunger for more and more and more. And this thirst is part of what we're calling a being. So the key thing about this little chain of logic, which we have a hard time relating to as we live our life, is that thirst is not only the cause of the arising of dukkha or unsatisfactoriness, it is within dukkha itself. Dukkha and the five aggregates are not different. The five aggregates are dukkha or unsatisfactoriness. So it is within what we call being. And there is nothing else outside of it. So here we are. We're not really as solid. There is really no I. And we are suffering from this unquenchable thirst. And it's part of who we are. So that makes it a quandary. What can we do about that? What can we do about that? Well, here's the good news. This thirst and impermanence are equal to dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. However, what arises automatically because of impermanence and the nature of the five aggregates also has the nature of cessation. Now, why should we care about that? Well, because it means that this very unsatisfactory world is exactly the way to complete equanimity, complete extinction of thirst and suffering. So, what's the implication of that? I certainly don't know all of them, but one of the ones that I've been trying to work with, according to the Buddha's Eightfold Path, is realizing, so everything that comes up that's noticeable, that registers as a joy or a sorrow, is itself the way. So I've been having any number of unexpected occurrences, like my car won't start. And then my phone started whacking out. And then when I got my car maybe fixed, we're not sure, I backed into the person that took me to the place where the car was. So this is all coming up, continually coming up. And because I've done a lot of work with what the Buddha taught about how things really are, because I've had a chance to experience it and with some space around it, with some different eyes, I now can take that and say, recognition. I recognize that this is an unhappy state that I'm in. Mental formations are forming and volition is arising that will, I know because I've been studying it, bring about unhappiness. And I also know that if I embrace this, then that's a way of extinguishing the very thing I'm experiencing, the very thing I am. because we need mental formations for the being to arise. There really isn't a being that's extinguished. It's just the universe functioning the way it is. So that allows for no change in how things are, seen from a completely different point of view. So now back to our questions. What time is it? I'm doing pretty well. What can we do? Well, the simple answer to that is we work the Eightfold Path. That's what the Eightfold Path is about. And what does it include? It includes view. Sound view. So that's what I've just been talking about. It's like this world doesn't work the way you think it does. And in particular, this you is just part of this world. There's a teacher that in Dokusan with a student is, I'm told, when the student said, you know, if there just wasn't a me, there wouldn't be a problem. And his teacher said, that's right, no person, no problem. That's view, right? Take the you out of somebody cutting you off in traffic, and it's just one car got in front of your car or this car, and they're all perpetually changing at the speed of light. So for a long time, let's see if I can remember it. I had something on in my Gmail signature that was like, something like, it's not the traffic. What is it?
You're not stuck in traffic.
You are the traffic. You are the traffic. Yeah, thank you. You're not stuck in traffic. You are the traffic. And that begins to start getting to be like, oh, it's great to take this kind of thing into traffic and just realize, wow, if I couldn't see, and if I didn't have the idea of a being, and if I didn't have the expectation that I needed to get to some place because otherwise, you know, something I wanted and I'm thirsting for will happen or won't happen, how would this ride be? Boy, it'd be a lot calmer. It would be just a lot calmer. It would be just what's happening. So a lot of working the Eightfold Path is tolerating the way things are. This is when Byakran talks, she'll say, allowing the world to be the way it is. Kind of. Now, it turns out that comes in really handy with the persons that we think are beings, too. Allowing them to be the way they are, arise the way they are. It's sort of an even-mindedness. So, still, what can we do? We can see suffering, and we can take up a vow, which we do when we say the great vows, which we do in our lives when we decide where we're going to put our life energy. We basically take up a vow. That's right intention in the list that is often called the list of the Eightfold Path. So we step into this invitation to look at things differently and just keep an open mind. Just keep an open mind. You don't have to have an opinion. Think about that. Think about that. You don't have to have an opinion. You can just recognize or not get in the way of recognition. Really? The universe includes opinions, but they're optional. Do they lead to happiness? I don't know that I could say that that's true. So this taking up a vow is part of the commercial. I think it's very much a part of answering the question, what if I don't feel like it? So anybody that's been in a practice period, that's been in a sesshin, that's just been a human being, says, well, this is who I'd like to be. This is what I'm aiming for. Whether we know that or not, it really helps to know it. It really helps to take up a vow that is far bigger than anything we can think that we can accomplish. It rises out of that unsatisfactoriness very naturally. And when we really are present to that unsatisfactoriness, particularly with a view that says, okay, so this is the way out. This is the part where I don't go to sleep. I don't, you know, do things to avoid this. I just am present. I am present with an inquiring, kind of open mind. When I do that, then something different can arise. Just lost my screen here. When we really are clear about our vow, I went and spent 3 years at a place called Great Vow, so that's just, you know, complete truthfulness there. And my name, my way name is Vow Mountain. So I really value vow as a way to combat the hindrances. The hindrances include torpor and sloth. They include restlessness and anxiety. They include doubt. It is jumping off of the 100-foot pole. What happens? What happens? We have to give up things that we want more and more and more and more of. And so when the question comes up, well, what if I don't feel like it? Then that vow really helps to help me switch to a different volition. Because there are volitions that can take us in the direction that is helpful, and there are volitions that can take us to an unquenchable hell. And that they don't help us and they don't help anybody else. So that class really is meant to do what we often do intuitively, which is as we come to the end of the year, and this is a tradition among Buddhist teachers in Japan anyway, is they prepare for their death at that juncture between the end of 1 year and the beginning of the next. There are many spiritual traditions that do something like this, where you come into full contact and you take stock. And it's hard to take stock if we never really were that clear about what we were aiming for. And it can be much easier to evaluate, well, what did I do? And was that in accord with the vow? And we don't, again, have to have an opinion about that. We can just recognize it. We can just say there's 6 of these and 10 of those. We can usually, without effort, know where we think we are. Not necessarily reliably, because shame is something that, you know, can go either way when it comes to helpfulness. So the class that I'm teaching is really meant to help us just get into touch with, well, what is my vow? And vows are like plants. Like when I go away from Hokyoji, I water them. I try to arrange to have them watered, and I leave the heat on because they can't live without that. And the vow can't live unless we are taking care of it every day. The more we are in the moment, the more we can take care of that vow. So the Eightfold Path also includes speech, livelihood, and action that's appropriate and helpful. The First Noble Truth is about understanding through mindfulness, which is also included in the Eightfold Path, exactly what direction things go based on what we're doing. We have to learn this by experience. We don't just intuitively know it. And we have to get it into our bodies. Speech is kind of wonderful because we do it every day. So it's a great one to be really mindful about. I have been struggling all of my life with thinking before I speak, thinking while I'm speaking, and being mindful after I've spoken. And while I'm still pretty bad at doing all of those things, I am getting better. And I'm understanding the happiness of doing the before, during, and after. It's possible for me to follow up later. So this process is continually reinforcing. We hear things, we don't understand them. But then all of a sudden we'll catch ourselves in the doing if we take up the wholehearted practice of mindfulness, continuous mindfulness, then that lets us catch things and see things with some space without a particular view. Or at the very least, notice that we're in a bad spot and that's like a flashing red light. Danger, danger. Will Rogers, you know. You're getting into danger, danger. And then when the shame comes up, we can kind of go, danger, danger again. I'm going to use my vow to straighten myself out. So that's really all about effort. Paying, which is another part of the Eightfold Path. And then concentration. We cannot just get a flashing light. And if we have, if we're easily distracted, if we are coming from torpor or sloth and just trying to ignore everything, we need concentration to take whatever, you know, to call up our vow energy, to call up our right view based on what we've heard, but also based on the experience that's stored away in the bazillion uncountable moments that are continually setting up the next being moment. We can also, the Buddha particularly recommends training in the seven enlightenment factors. So I just wanted to include that. I've been doing a lot of work, and I think probably a lot of people do this naturally, just working with gratitude, remembering to turn towards gratitude, to not leave out gratitude. Even for things like, my car started today and I didn't have to plug it in. I live with a woman that's probably 15 years older than I am, and she said, you know, the older you get, the more easily you will find things to be grateful for. Now that's Buddhist practice. That's beautiful Buddhist practice. Taking something that we normally think of as a suffering and saying, well, this opens up all kinds of things I can be grateful for. But gratitude is something that will... It's very much a volition. It's like, wait a minute, I'm just going to stop and be grateful here and think about all the things that I'm leaving out of this moment, which is continually changing. and doesn't have a fixed eye. So it's though that accumulation that basically opens the heart. That's where the compassion comes from, because there's a balance there. We're not, you know, over the top joyous, but joy is a kind of energy. And it's an energy that, because we are not separate from any part of being, any part of function, that can be felt throughout the whole thing. So that leads into, well, what is at stake? It's important to remember that. It's very hard to do that when you're young, although some young people are really kind of extraordinary in that way. So no fixed idea about that. But as we get older, you know, I'm 69 now, and I get up and I'm grateful that I'm still not dead and I still have a chance to do some work of basically taking care of compassion and wisdom. I can, you know, wake up in the middle of the night and I'll see my mind chewing away at something, some old grudge, or oh no, what am I going to say in this part of the talk, you know, or, you know, this, oh, that won't go, or, you know, all those things. You know, it's sort of like, you know, it's really been bugging me, that thing that I haven't really let go of yet about, really, I haven't been getting enough attention. And this ability with practice, because you can't do it without practice, to pivot. My friend GD is in the audience, and she uses that word, and I love it, because it is such a good picture, I think, of what it takes. It's like, bam, pivot. Bam, pivot. You know, and if you really get beat over the head by your thirst, which isn't yours, just the thirst out there, because there's plenty of the thirst, right? Well, then, it's a continuous process. It turns out that's exactly what we need to do to realize nirvana, which is the extinction of unquenchable thirst. So knowing what's at stake is helpful for focus. I can spend days reading novels, and now I'm more thoughtful about that. It, first of all, it's an unquenchable thirst. It's a more. I can never get enough books, right? But it's like, well, are you grateful for the time you spend with your books? It's like, well, you know, up to a point, yes. But beyond that point, what I really need to be doing is pay more attention all the way along the way. It's not a burden. I really found it much easier now to embrace continuous mindfulness, because what it is continually being in this moment in this life. Everything else is a mental formation. At least, who knows what else it is? And it's certainly impermanent. So remembering what's at stake and remembering vow is my main go-to when I don't feel like it. I definitely make bad choices, you know, pretty much every day. I don't like to count them, but I've realized counting isn't so important as just being present while they're happening, right? So it's just really interesting how things come to you when you step wholeheartedly into vow, and then you just are completely magnanimous about all the mistakes you make along the way. You welcome those mistakes. So Here's a reading from my book that I try to read from every day because it's got a lot of wisdom. What is at stake? So this one says, unconditional love is an expression of love that is not based upon pleasant feelings. It instead is unlimited. Anyone who meets an individual with unconditional love can experience its presence. And the one who expresses it becomes a loving person. Let's hear it for interdependent co-origination. It is similar to a flower that emits its fragrance without regard to the worth of those who smell it. So I just want to say tiny, tiny, tiny things, whether it's just a generous frame of mind, the present is the setup for the future. So if we're concerned about our next moment or anybody else's next moment, that's what's at stake. That's something that what we choose affects forever and ever, eternally. And we might even have time for questions. No, we don't. Child, I'm really good at that now. I don't go over, but so I'll just keep working it. Yes, the way out. Just keep working it. Okay.
There's probably time for one question.
Okay. Does anybody have a question they'd like to put to me? Yes.
What's the book you're referring to?
Oh, the one that these readings came out of? It's a book that says wisdom, and then there's something else on it. I might have it. I think I have it with me. So if you're really interested, I think it's in the closet where my street clothes are. So I can get it out for you. Thank you for asking.